So I want to give a brief introduction and overview of Taoism, because it seems helpful to have a framework as we explore this tradition. And hopefully this will do several things. One, it will give a sense of the unique flavor of this tradition. Secondly, it will give a sense of some of the universals that are common to all great spiritual and religious traditions. Hopefully it will also give a flavor of the way in which this and other traditions tend to evolve, going through cycles, developing, evolving, growing, maturing, and then falling back and going through revivals. And hopefully we'll also give a sense of some of the key elements that all traditions have. Every great religious tradition has a metaphysics, a view of reality. It has an anthropology, a view of what a human being is. It has a psychology, an understanding of the mind, and with that goes a diagnosis of the mind, what is wrong, and what is wrong with human beings, the assumption in all traditions being, of course, that there is some dilemma or problem, and a remedy or treatment. All traditions also have an ethic or a set of values and guidelines for how to live life skillfully and fully and effectively. And finally, they contain a set of practices. So hopefully then we'll get a sense of the unique flavor of this tradition and also of the commonalities. So Taoism emerged out of one of the great civilizations of human history. It has origins going back many thousands of years to the rise of agriculture in what is now China, and which led to the formation of villages centered along the great rivers. And they centered largely on rice cultivation, which of course impacted the world enormously. In fact, 21% of the world's calories come from rice. So this is a grain which has spread from there dramatically. But then a little over 3,000 years ago, there was a growing unification, which came as a result of enormous conflict, but there was also this unification into the first dynasty, the Chu dynasty, some 1,200 years before the Common Era. And at the center of culture at that time was, as with so many cultures prior to the great traditions, was a shamanic basis. The shamans being the first systematic or organized spiritual tradition, the shamans being the first people who actually learned how to induce altered states of consciousness, to work with the mind, to induce states in which they are able to access intuitive wisdom, in which they were able to, as they experienced, work with spiritual powers. But then, in the so-called classical period, which is about 700 to 200 years before the Common Era, emerged the great religious traditions of China, Taoism and Confucianism. And you'll notice here the extraordinary synchronicity, because it's exactly in this period that emerged the great traditions in so many cultures. The great Hindu teachings arose at this time. This was the era of the Buddha, of Mahavira, of Zoroastra. In fact, this, of course, is the Axial Age, the period in which there was this enormous jump in human consciousness, in the evolution of consciousness. It was the breakthrough from the subtle mental realms in which the shamans voyaged and experienced themselves, traveling and interacting with spirits and gaining power from them. It was the breakthrough from the gross physical realm, beyond even the gross subtle realm, the breakthrough into the causal realm, the unmanifest, the indescribable, So this was an extraordinary period of breakthrough in China, as in other traditions. And various philosophic and spiritual geniuses arose at that time. Confucius and Mencius, the two great early sages of the Confucian tradition. Mao Tzu, who espoused universal love and advocated that love, that the love was the pathway and the antidote to the travails of human life. Xunzi, who was the great military strategist, and you'll see on the book, if you go into the bookstores, you will find his book, The Art of War, still one of the best sellers in our time, for better or for worse. And the giants of Taoism, Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu in particular. And this is therefore called the classic period of Taoism. And the great text, which was the first to emerge, is this text which we're looking at, the Tao Te Ching, sometimes translated as The Way and Its Power, and usually attributed to a semi-legendary sage Lao Tzu, but actually clearly by textual analysis the work of several people, and probably a compilation of texts that accrued around this period. At the heart of the Tao Te Ching is a vision of the Tao, the One, the underlying reality, which is the source of all things and that to which all things return. And there are some beautiful descriptions that we've read here in the Inner Treasure. And the Tao Te Ching begins with the famous verse, "That which can be called the Tao is not the eternal Tao. That which can be called the name is not the eternal name. Tao and this world seem different, but in truth they are one and the same. The only difference is the name we give them. How deep and mysterious this unity is, how profound, how great. It is the truth beyond the truth, the mystery beyond the mind. It is the path to all wonder, the gate to the ecstatic nature of all things. It is something formless, complete in itself. There before heaven and earth, tranquil, vast, standing alone, unchanging, it provides for all things without being exhausted. It is the mother of the universe. I do not know its name, so I call it Tao. Forced to name it further, I call it that which is beyond the beyond, that to which all things return. Eyes look, but cannot see it. Ears listen, but cannot hear it. Hands grasp, but cannot touch it. Beyond the senses lies this unity, invisible, inaudible, intangible. Know everything in this moment, and you will know the eternal Tao." So here, once again, we have a tradition breaking through to the realization of, and then attempting to point to, that which can't be described, that which can't be named, because it's not a thing. Pointing to that which is beyond all names, that which is, in technical terms, transconceptual, beyond all concepts. It's not a thing. It can't be sensed, it can't be touched, and yet it is the ground out of which all things arise. And this, of course, is a common theme of all the great contemplative traditions, the recognition that there is a reality which underlies this. And the core of the perennial wisdom, the core of the wisdom or the so-called perennial philosophy which is common to all the great traditions, is that reality is there is a deeper aspect to reality beyond that which we can see and touch. So that's the metaphysics. The anthropology is that we as human beings partake of that deeper reality. We're kind of like amphibians living in both worlds, except our awareness of that underlying reality is usually obscured by our mental activity, by our craving, our fears, our attachment, our aversions, and the ceaseless agitation which clouds and obscures that which is far subtler than any sensory input. And so Taoism, as with other traditions, says that that which is actually the underlying source and reality can only be known when the agitation which obscures and reduces our sensitivity, which clouds our awareness, which veils consciousness, is thinned, reduced, and removed. And then only can we directly know, not sense, but directly know, that which is imperceivable and ungraspable. And then only can we know the Tao and sense its underlying benevolence or care. So in the Tao Te Ching, the Tao is inherently benevolent. And the sage is one who knows this Tao. The sage is one who not only knows this reality, the Tao, but lives in accord with it, for whom living a spiritual or Taoistic life is a natural expression of the recognition of the Tao and of who and what we really are. This is a flowing with, a great emphasis in this tradition on allowing and flowing with reality. A relinquishment of struggle, a relinquishment of effort, a going beyond the intellect to intuition, and intuiting what is called for in each moment. And Taoism is filled with stories of sages just acting spontaneously in accord with the way, as the saying goes. Now, interestingly, at this stage, the Tao Te Ching and the early texts don't give us much in the way of practices. They really give us just hints of suggesting living in nature, not being concerned with external rewards, with fame, with money, with honors, relinquishing attachment to any conventions. This, of course, is an encouragement to move to the transconventional level. And so the suggestions, or they're really just hints, are to attune ourselves to reality and to live intuitively with it. Only centuries later do we get systematic contemplative practices, and this is also a theme we see in Confucianism. Confucianism arose as a social movement, an ethical revival, a response to the enormous political upheavals and suffering of the time. It was only centuries later that it became really a spiritual tradition. So we have then the emerging of this profound spiritual intuition, initially without much in the way of practices. And then in subsequent centuries, by the beginnings of the Common Era, the inevitable happened, as we see with each tradition. Taoism got organized and became an organized religion. Lao Tzu got kicked upstairs and became a god and was called the Great Lord on High. Taoism was organized, there was a priesthood was instituted, sacred rituals were formalized, new scriptures were developed, and basically you got what I call the ritualization of religion, or as which someone eloquently called it, truth decay. An emphasis on ritual and prayer to the deities, and the rising of a mythological worldview. Now, later, we actually got the development, the evolution of a true mystical tradition here. We got the formation of a gradual accrual of systematic spiritual contemplative practices. And interestingly enough, this is one of the few contemplative traditions that originated with a woman, Lady Wei by name. And Lady Wei started contemplative tradition in an interesting way. She received a revelation from the deities, the so-called guardians of the Tao, and wrote down their teachings in a book. In other words, she channeled it. And, you know, it's very interesting. Channeling had a big heyday a decade or two ago with kind of relics of the New Age. But it's interesting how you find channeling in each of the great traditions, people having revelations and bringing through what is often an enormous amount of trivia and sometimes is real transcendent material. And it points to potentials and capacities of mind which we are way beyond what we usually acknowledge in the psyche. And so she was the originator of the whole school and tradition of contemplative practice. It was popularized subsequently by a man who, and I should mention the Lady Wei in turn was elevated to a god herself or a deity herself. But the tradition was promulgated by a man who received a vision and transmission from her while stoned out of his brain on cannabis. He apparently was using cannabis systematically and had these visions, again with some real profundity. And this tradition, interestingly, came from a woman and specifically from psychedelics. Now, actually, a number of traditions were probably helped along by psychedelics, but this is just an interesting example, one we know in detail. The core beliefs were interesting. They believed that they had a cosmology. The highest realm was the One, or the Tao. And then below that were the Three, which were basically energetic expressions of the Tao. Three kinds of energy: spiritual energy, qi, which we all know of from Tai Chi, etc., and sexual energy. And a central element of Taoist practice is a refinement of these elements. They're taking sexual energy and refining it into qi, taking qi and refining it into spirit energy or sheng, and then refining even the spiritual energy so it becomes the vapor of the Tao. So there's a big emphasis on this tradition on energetic refinement. And for this, it's necessary to reduce desires and to still the mind. And so we find a number of the practices, such as the one we just were practicing, stilling the mind, sitting in quietness, sitting in forgetfulness. And along with these, a variety of purification practices. Purification practices being central to every tradition, the core idea, that in order to refine sensitivity, to go beyond thinking, one really needs to purify, that is, reduce problematic emotions such as anger and hatred, anger, fear and hatred, to cultivate beneficial ones, to purify thoughts that lead of greed, hatred, anger, those drives, etc. So a gradual purification process. Okay. And this set of practices evolved over time into Taoist alchemy, which were two main kinds, and there was a kind of competition between external Taoist alchemy and internal Taoist alchemy for centuries. The external alchemy focused particularly on the body and on various calisthenics, on working with energies and working with sexuality, and also with working with substances, doing, trying to find the pill of immortality. At this time, it was believed that physical immortality was possible, and so one of the goals devolved into physical immortality. Not so well, because a number of the substances they used included lead, mercury, zinc, nickel, silver, and arsenic oxide. Now, the emperors were big on not only power but longevity, so they employed these external alchemists. An enormous number of alchemists and emperors died. So eventually, internal alchemy won out, primarily because the external alchemists killed themselves. And with this, external alchemists died off, the goal shifted from physical immortality to liberation and awakening in a more spiritual perspective. An internal alchemy effectively in the West, as in China, as in so many places, you know, there's a whole history of alchemy in the West. And again, you find the same thing happening, that being two kinds of alchemy. The alchemy which is the kind of the so-called alchemy, external, or the quest to transmute metals into gold, so-called. But this, by the spiritual alchemist, was regarded as aurum vulgarum, the vulgar gold, whereas the real aim of the alchemy in the West and in Taoist alchemy is the transmutation of a human being into the pure gold, the actually refined, pure human being. And the patriarch of internal alchemy was a sage by the name of Lu Tung Pin, and he's become the archetype of wisdom in this tradition, and is a beautiful image. He symbolized, he was thinking of a life in politics, but he realized the futility of that and went into the wilderness to practice. And he's portrayed in paintings as carrying a broom or a whisk with which he brushes away the dust that covers the Tao. So with internal alchemy, the goal was the cultivation of body and mind, and the process was used meditations, yogas, energy work with the energy, sexual, and some sexual yogas. And then about 1,000 years ago, there was a great transformation in Chinese culture, a great period. At this time, once again, there'd been enormous numbers of wars and political unrest. The Confucians, who had really tried to set themselves up as teachers and ethical teachers for the state, basically a lot of them ended up beheaded. So they became more interested in contemplation and internal work. And by this time, Buddhism had become very influential. So there was this great synthesis of Taoism, Buddhism, and Confucianism, which resulted in three things. It resulted in what's called Neo-Confucianism, or the great synthesis of Confucianism. In Taoism, it resulted in so-called complete reality school, because various sages came to believe that the most effective spiritual realization would come from a melding of Confucian ethics that is the goal to benefit all people. Taoist practices and Buddhist insight into Shunyata, or the fundamental nature of reality. And this would allow a return to the so-called original mind, or the Tao. And then the third, so the three things that came out of this, but if you look across any tradition, you find that intense yogic practices, deep meditation, precise philosophical analysis, these are usually the province of an elite, a self-selected group of people who really decide to go for it, to really go for awakening or liberation or understanding or insight. And often they become monastics, they join a community and dedicate themselves to very intense practice. But for most people settle for prayer, for devotion, and for an ethical lifestyle. And so the most widespread of the Taoist traditions became what's called action and karma yoga. That is, it centers on a lifestyle based on the idea that, as with the Indian karmic traditions, whatever we do leaves an imprint on us, on the psyche, and in our lives, and that by living ethically in a way to benefit others as much as we can, we accrue good karma, good fortune, and for those into rebirth, a favorable rebirth. But the ultimate goal is awakening. And in Taoism, there are three main levels of awakening. The first is what is called the high pure realm. And this is basically when one comes into full alignment with the Tao. One's life is an intuitive apprehension of alignment with an expression of the Tao. One's life is really aligned with and spontaneously expressing the fundamental nature of reality. The second of the three levels is the great pure realm. And here, both self and world are recognized as manifestations of Tao. There's still a sense of separation, but it's not just that one is aligned with the Tao, but one sees all things and oneself as expressions or manifestations of Tao. And then the final level of realization is the jade pure realm, in which there is complete unity with the Tao. That is, the sense of separate self dissolves into the Tao or into reality. All phenomena are recognized as reality. There's no sense of separation at all. There's no sense of separate self. There's the recognition that the separate self is an illusory construct and that all there is the Tao. And there's nothing outside the Tao. And you'll recognize this as a common theme from many traditions. Those of you who know the Zen ox herding picture, remember the eighth ox herding picture, return to the source. And there's a beautiful, in the commentary begins with a beautiful line, return to the source. Ah, this is already an error, because the very idea of returning to the source presupposes that you could leave it. And both Zen and Taoism appreciate that actually the very idea that we're outside the Tao or failed to be aligned with it is an illusion, and that actually we never needed to return to the Tao. That what was actually called for was a recognition that we have always been and are always expressing the Tao. It's a beautiful vision, culmination of thousands of years of people exploring, delving, feeling into, intuiting, and developing this beautiful family of practices, many common elements of which we'll recognize, but also bringing this unique flavor, this beautiful emphasis on intuiting, feeling, trusting, aligning with, not interfering with, non-efforting, non-striving, even non-doing, eventually coming to the recognition that, and this is of course a very profound realization and stage, that any effort is itself comes at any struggle, any effort itself comes out of an illusory sense of separation. And that when we, that just as we in this meditation experience the possibility that all we had to do was relax and let go, that can be a way of life. It's a beautiful vision.